Welcome to Preservation Workflow, part of the technical practicum for this convention. And I'd like to introduce our first speaker, who is Mike Casey. He's the Associate Director for Recording Services at Indiana University's Archives of Traditional Music and co-chair of ARSC's Technical Committee. He is the co-author of Sound Directions, Best Practices for Audio Preservation, and project manager for the Sound Directions Project at Indiana University. He is the creator of FACET, the Field Audio Collection Evaluation Tool, and is the author of FACET Format, Characteristics and Preservation Problems, a document that explores the degradation issues for field audio formats. He is also adjunct faculty in the Indiana University School of Library and Information Science, where he teaches a class in audio preservation. His topic this morning is called Scaling Up, Increasing Audio Preservation Efficiency Through Automation and Parallel Transfers. Essentially, it concerns workflow that can be defined as a sequence of processes undertaken to transform inputs into outputs to repeatedly achieve a goal. Less formally, it may be thought of as the glue that ties processes together. Because audio preservation requires significant resources and audio collections are often large, it is critical to design workflows that are efficient and effective, conserving time and money while ensuring high-quality work. This presentation will explore several approaches to increasing efficiency within an audio preservation system. It will examine the development of workflow scripts at the Archives of Traditional Music as part of the Sound Directions project previously mentioned, automating the tasks that may be done faster and more accurately by machines. It will also report on research into the use of parallel or simultaneous transfers of analog originals, calculating the risks and benefits of using the procedure for the types of recordings found in the research archives. May I introduce Mike Casey.
Thanks, Seth. It's great to be here. I want to start just by saying that we have a problem. And the problem is one that I certainly have at my archives, and I bet it's one that you have at your archives as well. And I can really sum up this problem with just three words: degradation, obsolescence, and numbers. We have lots of these kinds of things at the Archives of Traditional Music. Some of them look like this. Some of them, unfortunately, look like this. What we have are analog audio recordings that are deteriorating, sometimes catastrophically, some deteriorating more slowly, but all are deteriorating nonetheless. The formats themselves are becoming obsolete. That means that it's becoming harder and harder to find playback machines, parts for playback machines, supplies, the expertise to know how to align the old machines and to get the best play from that historical sound recording. This is a problem that we've been talking about at this conference and other conferences, and I think is well known. And we know we need to digitize our collections in order to hopefully solve the problem. The piece of this problem that I want to talk about today is the large numbers piece, and that we have large numbers of these deteriorating analog audio recordings. How many do we have? Well, on the IU Bloomington campus, we know that we have somewhere over 300,000 audio recordings. At the Archives of Traditional Music, where I work, we have somewhere over 110,000 recordings. So we have what would be considered, I think, moderate size, mid-size holdings for an archive. Certainly not comparable to the Library of Congress, but larger than many other collections. I ran some numbers recently. I tried to estimate how long it would take to hit for one audio engineer, which is what we have right now, one preservation transfer engineer funded by a grant, using a typical one-to-one transfer workflow, that is one engineer and recording one object at a time, one recording at a time. And I calculated it would take us 58 years to digitize our collection. That's not so bad, but there are a few caveats, as you can see. How much time do we have? Can we wait for 58 years to do this? I don't think we can. I think we have 15 to 20 years to do this work. Less for some formats. Lacquer discs and digital audio tapes can't wait for 20 years. Probably can't even wait for 10 or 15 years. And that's because of these two issues, again, the twin challenges of degradation and obsolescence. In 15 or 20 years, the analog originals will either be unplayable or we'll be getting a much poorer quality playback than we would today. And obsolescence will progress to the point where it will simply be prohibitively costly, way too expensive to acquire the machines and the people to run the machines to do these transfers. So I think this is work that needs to be done within our generation. I see it as our central task as archivists. For us, this is an institutional issue, and we have recently been taking steps to go to our institution and say, hey, if you want this content to be available for researchers in another 20 years, we need to do something. But it also is a workflow issue. So from sort of a global approach of talking with our institution, we've also had to look at the way that we do things and ask ourselves, are we doing things as efficiently as possible? Are there ways to increase throughput within our audio preservation system to get more of this done? So we embarked upon an efficiency study at the Archives of Traditional Music. And this was all done under the auspices of the Sound Directions Project, which most of you probably know about, collaboration with Harvard University that has resulted in a best practices document. And this is funded by NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities. And I'm quite happy, literally thrilled to say that NEH has awarded us another grant this season so that the Sound Directions Project will continue to move forward for the next couple of years. And I think we have some nice contributions to make to the field over the next couple of years. Much of the heavy lifting with what I'm about to talk about has been done by project staff, three of whom are here at ARSC, and you can find them and talk to them if you want more information about what we're doing. So we started with an analysis of our audio preservation system. One of the first things we did is we brought in Chris Lasinic at Audio Visual Preservation Solutions to help us think about our workflow and actually brainstorm ways in which we might make it more efficient. We also benefited greatly over the years from conversations with George Blood at Safe Sound Archive. That operation has been addressing these kinds of things systematically for a number of years now. And I should also say that we didn't start from scratch. We had a nice model from our colleagues at Harvard who had automated much of their workflow during phase one of Sound Directions. And Bruce from Harvard is here, and you can talk with him about what they do. We focused on two things that I'll talk about today, automation and parallel transfers. Let's start with automation. What do I mean by automation? Basically, this is using scripts or software applications to process files, create digital objects, to collect metadata automatically. This is in the post-digitization part of the transfer chain. This is what happens after the engineer has created files, and then it's time to do something with those files. Our goals are to increase the amount of work we can do, increase the speed at which it's done with the files in the post-dig part of the process, also to increase accuracy, to use machines for what they can do more accurately than human beings can do. You can also think of it just in general as doing more with the audio content that's already in the post-digitization process within your system. You can also think about it this way. Skilled work requires human beings. Repetitive tasks, well, we can't use donkeys anymore. But we'll use computers for the repetitive tasks. So we began by analyzing every task that the audio engineer and the project assistant undertake and asking ourselves what could be automated. We realized a couple of things very quickly. One is we wanted to limit our interaction with WaveLab, which is our audio recording software, because anytime you put something in WaveLab and you render a file or do anything, it's very inefficient. We also realized that we wanted to batch files overnight, process them overnight, take advantage of that unused time. So that was a goal early on. It will help to understand a little bit about our workflow. In our workflow, we pair an audio engineer who's the technical expert, who has the knowledge to get the optimal playback from these historical sound recordings, with a project assistant who is trained in library science or in archival studies and may also have some content expertise. And these two people use software and scripts, tools that are developed by our project programmer. Let's take a look at what the project engineer actually does. Sets up the playback machine. Sets up the studio. Evaluates and diagnoses the recording. Previews the recording, setting levels. Adjusts azimuth or chooses the stylus, depending on whether it's a tape or a disc that he's working with. Selects a file name for the digital file about to be created. Begins transfer. Enters metadata on the analog recording. enters metadata into the broadcast wave BEX chunk. We talked about this yesterday in one of the sessions. Does a little bit of quality control of the file. Creates a processing history instance. This documents who did the transfer, how it was done, all the equipment that was done, with the settings of all the gear, and enters this metadata. Parses the preservation master file to gather metadata about the file itself. Creates a record in our metadata software, which is called ATMC, for that digital file. Enters metadata into ATMC. Uploads to the NAS. NAS is our interim storage solution, network attached storage is what that stands for. And then once you move any files around, you have to verify the checksums. Well, that's a lot. Here's how the tasks look with automation. Set up the playback machine. Well, we need a human being to do that. Set up the studio, evaluate, diagnose the recording. These are all skills that we use audio engineers for. This is what we want to have them focus on doing. Here are some things we don't want them to focus on doing. We want to try to automate. And so we built some functionality into our metadata software that will select the file name, and the engineer can override that, of course. Create that file for that record for the digital file in the metadata software, create the processing history instance, and enter most of the processing history metadata. This happens by way of the engineer answering a series of 6 or 7 questions right when starting work. It goes very quickly. And then the system also relies upon some login information to fill in operator details. The engineer still has to begin the transfer. Still has to enter metadata on that analog recording because he is the person that's holding that disc or tape in his hand and knows what it's about. Does a little bit of QC. Here are some things that the script does running overnight. All of our broadcast wave BEX chunk metadata is automatically entered into the broadcast wave file. The digital file is parsed. Much metadata is entered into the metadata software, ATMC. Upload to the NAS and verifying checksums all happens automatically overnight. So that's significant increase in productivity for the engineer, and it's a very significant increase in accuracy. Project assistant, the story is even more dramatic. What does this person do in our workflow? Starts by downloading copies of preservation master files to work on. Of course, verifying checksums when you do that. Doing a bunch of quality control for the things that the engineer has produced. Puts markers in files to mark the beginnings of performances. Names those markers. Creates an index for the recording, renders a production master file, adds metadata to the broadcast wave BEX chunk, parses that production master to get the metadata and to create checksums, creates that metadata software record, puts metadata into it, all done by hand, creates the processing history instance, creates an ADL. This is the AES 31-3 standard that also was discussed yesterday. Creates an ADL that points to the preservation master. Another one that points to the production master. Uploads to the NAS. Verifies the checksums. This is a lot of work. All done by hand. With automation, well, we start by downloading the files and verifying the checksums overnight so that the next day's work is ready to go. That saves some time right there. Then there's a few things that still need to be done by a human being, quality control, for example. Putting those markers in files where you may need some content expertise to find the right locations, creating an index. But then the overnight script does a whole lot of work for us. Naming the markers, creating that production master file, creating files, entering metadata, creating the ADLs, uploading to the NAS, verifying checksums, is all done overnight for the batch of files that were worked with during the day. Now, this last little item there, down here at the bottom, we're still working on that. The cream and the sugar is a problem. The programmers can't quite get the quantities right, so we'll keep working on that. What has this given us? Remember, our goal is to increase speed and accuracy. Well, accuracy has definitely happened. I don't have any numbers for accuracy, but I can tell you by experience, and our project staff will tell you, that accuracy has definitely gone up. We've seen a 75 to 200% increase in productivity for the project assistant, depending on the collection. We're still gathering numbers. This research is still ongoing. But that is huge. That is a huge jump in productivity from what we had before. It's a revolution. I remember Harvard telling me early on that their automation had revolutionized their workflow. Now I understand what they meant by revolution. It has absolutely revolutionized what we do. So I think we've reached our goal. We can do more with the content that's already in the post-digitization part of the system. The next question we needed to ask ourselves was, can we get more content into that part of the system? You know, we've got the scripts that can act on that content very efficiently. Can we get more there in any given period of time, which should help us to increase our productivity even further? And that takes us into the world of parallel transfers. Parallel transfer, there are other names for this: multiple transfers, simultaneous transfers, automated transfers. We're using the word parallel. It's digitizing more than one tape, let's say, at a time. So running two cassettes or three cassettes, or some people run five or eight cassettes at the same time. And we hope that this will give us a huge increase in productivity paired with automation. Now, this technique has been used in broadcast archives for many, many years, particularly in Europe and Australia. It's not new. It's not particularly controversial within that setting. There's much experience. Now, broadcast archives have typically very homogeneous collections. They have tapes. They're all recorded professionally. They're all set up and structured the same. They all have test tones at the beginning. You know, obvious candidates for running more than one at a time. We happen to work and live in a research archive, which is kind of a different animal. We have lots of tapes. They're all recorded. Most of them are recorded. But they're recorded by collectors with varying skill levels, recorded all over the world with different kinds of machines. And they contain, how shall I say this, many surprises. Let's put it that way. And they can be very difficult to work with. We also have disks and cylinders and so forth, so it's a very different setting. I'll also note that capturing analog sound put out by NRPB and CLEAR had pointed to this area as recommendation number 4 in priority. And we thought that we might be able to add to this dialogue. When you're doing parallel transfers, there is thought to be a greater potential risk. And I'll use the word potential here because I want to revisit this in just a moment and maybe re-examine it a little bit. And that's because any given recording gets less than 100% of the audio engineer's attention. So there's the risk that the engineer will miss something that will then get into the digital file and will reside there essentially forever. Our objectives in doing this R&D were to develop a safe application for parallel transfers within a research archive setting. And we wanted to have a high degree of confidence that what we were doing was high quality, and also find some strategies for mitigating the risk of what we're doing. I'm just going to quickly describe one of our applications. We have several, and again, this research is ongoing, so in fact, your comments and questions may help shape the rest of the research, and we very much would like to hear those. I'll just quickly describe what we call our 3x2 parallel mono. This is running three cassette decks at a time while prepping the other three. Let's look at a picture which might make it a little clearer. On the left here, you see three cassette decks. We'll run three cassettes at a time. The engineer will then prep the next three on the right side using this right bank. When the left side is done, when the A sides on the left side are done, we'll start up the A sides on the right side. And then the engineer will start prepping on the left side, the next batch, all the while monitoring the transfer that's being undertaken. And more on monitoring as we go along. There are two areas in which we thought that we could work on strategies for mitigating risk. One is selection. You can think about it as triage. The other is monitoring. And I don't have a lot of time to go into detail, but I just want to hit some of the highlights in these areas. The goals of the selection part of parallel transfer are to assign recordings either to a one-to-one custom transfer workflow or to parallel transfer. And once we have recordings that are designated for that parallel transfer stream, to then create batches of like items to keep the transfer running smoothly and to keep the engineer moving forward through these very quickly. There are certain things that automatically go into a one-to-one workflow for us, including all disk recordings, and you can see some of the other things here as well. And I might also say an issue that we have not resolved yet, but we're talking about, is what to do about high-value or extremely well-recorded content, which you think might be very appropriate for parallel transfer. It's in good condition. It sounds great. But if it's really high value, maybe you want that custom attention to it. That's an interesting question. So for us, parallel transfer candidates are, in terms of formats, yeah. We can talk about any of those later, the problems that they present. Analog audio cassettes and open reel tapes are our candidates for parallel transfer. And I'm going to highlight two little parts of the selection workflow for parallel transfer that I think are worth thinking about and maybe talking about. One is we start with a visual inspection. I'm leaving out a few steps here, obviously, but the project assistant conducts a visual inspection of a collection. The purpose of this inspection is to assess the suitability for parallel transfer, and if it seems to be suitable, then to start creating preliminary parallel transfer batches for the engineer to work on. So the project assistant will examine tape brands, tape bases, lengths, visible problems, look at our collection documentation, try to figure out if we have spoken word or music, because we try to separate the two into different batches. We'll do some limited playback of several items if necessary. Often it's not, sometimes it is. And then the project assistant will try to create these preliminary batches for us to work with, usually by tape brand, tape length, and whether it's spoken word or music. And then the project engineer gets the material. And the project engineer does a playback inspection. This happens during transfer. So what we're doing is we're combining the kinds of things that you need to do anyhow to transfer a recording with this playback inspection, the goal of which is to redirect problem items to a one-to-one workflow. So the engineer is getting these preliminary batches, and while three cassettes are transferring, is inspecting the next three and is saying, okay, playing them back, diagnosing problems. Okay, this one's a discard. This needs to go to a one-to-one. This one's fine. We'll move forward with this. The engineer will do that inspection, and then we'll do all of the things. Well, I've got a slide that says this. We'll do all of the things that you need to do to get ready to record anyhow. So inspection and diagnosis, then exercising the tape, setting azimuth, setting levels, and getting the next batch of cassettes ready to go. Obviously, we've made some workflow choices here, which I'll just quickly mention. We thought about combining the two inspections, the visual and the playback. In some ways, that makes sense. Do it all at once, right? But what we felt was that would have to be done by the engineer, since it would be a playback inspection. And that, in fact, it just simply takes too long. I don't want to pay the engineer to take that much time. I want the engineer to focus on using his critical listening skills and technical abilities. So we separated the two out. We also felt that if you're going to wind a tape in order to exercise it, in order to preview to set levels, that really you should just press play at that point and just go with it. So that played into this choice as well. And obviously, if you're adjusting azimuth on a machine, if you've got a machine set up for a tape, then you need to do it on the same machine. So this kind of a structure is what really made sense to us. But it's arguable. There's definitely other ways to do this. The next area in which we wanted to try to work on mitigating risk was monitoring. And some of the goals that we outlined, which may become basic principles for us, this one's pretty obvious: monitor every source as much as possible. But we also wanted to automate the switching between sources. I'm going to talk about all of these. Have a primary focus on one source, but be able to hear all of them all of the time. Have quick and easy identification of the playback machine from listening. You hear a problem in a speaker, you know immediately what machine it comes from. And then be able to quickly focus on that machine, on just listening to that speaker, if indeed there seems to be a problem. Let's look at some of these goals. Automated switching. We felt that we wanted to rely on software to switch between the, let's take the example of three cassettes at a time, to switch between the three cassettes rather than the engineer. What I didn't want was the engineer saying, okay, it's time to switch to number two. Oops, I'm 2 minutes late. Better get to number three. Really, it made a lot of sense to take that burden off of the engineer and automate the switching between the sources, forcing the engineer's attention to move from source to source automatically. And we felt that there was a greater chance of uncovering problems if we did that. These are the goals of primary focus on one source, but hearing all of them, and then quick and easy idea of the playback machine. The idea of a physical correspondence of playback machines and speakers. And then, actually, maybe I'll show this to you. This might be easier. The top cassette deck goes to the left speaker. The middle cassette deck goes to the middle speaker. The right goes to the middle speaker. Same thing on the other side. So that if you hear a problem in one speaker, you can. If you hear a problem in the middle of the speaker, you can go to the middle deck automatically. So that's one aspect of that. The other thing that I want to talk about is a Pro Tools monitoring session that we set up for monitoring. This automatic switching, and here I realize I've forgotten my notes, so I'll wing this. We have a Pro Tools session that is essentially a monitoring chain that's completely separate from the transfer chain, although it's fed by it, that automates the switching between speakers, between cassette decks. And you can see a mock-up of this right here. So basically what it does is that it starts by putting the focus on the left speaker, the top cassette deck, for 6 seconds. That speaker is 15 dB higher than the other ones, but the other two you can still hear. And the fact that you can hear the other two, although at a much lower level, means that if there are any gross problems, if something big happens, you'll hear it in one of those speakers, and you should be able to actually go to that speaker and find out the problem. We use, at the moment, we're using 6 seconds per speaker, which means that any given cassette deck is not out of the engineer's primary focus for more than 15 seconds, and we find that this works pretty well. In order to facilitate, watch what happens to the LED here, to facilitate locating the playback deck that's giving us a problem, we're also experimenting with LEDs that move from speaker to speaker, or from machine to machine, as the speaker is focused. So when this speaker is the primary focus, the LED lights up on the machine. So if you hear a problem, all you have to do is look for the light. This is something we've just done a proof of concept for, and we're going to explore a little bit further. I want to review quickly, just step back and look at the gold standard, the one-to-one transfer standard. Here's the scenario we often find ourselves in. We're going to do 4 or more weeks of cassettes, 45 minutes per side, non-English spoken word material. So the engineer gets things set up and has 30 minutes, does all the metadata entry, the tape's running. You've got 30 minutes or more of just sitting there listening to this stuff that you don't understand. There's a lot of downtime, potential for disengagement. Any good engineer will say, yeah, I can keep one ear on the transfer and... it all happens. We find some advantages to the parallel transfer workflow. It's engaging. It forces the engineer to pay attention or else you just get lost and you're sunk. So it's sonically and intellectually engaging, and even though it's more demanding, it's rewarding and efficient, we think. There are some other workflow advantages. It's easy to detect changes in fidelity. You've got a cassette where some oxide is building up on the head, and you're losing high frequency. In a one-to-one workflow, you're listening to that happening. You think it's happening. You're not sure. You're thinking, how did this cassette sound 10 minutes ago? What did the cassette yesterday sound like? Memory is a very bad way to try to do that sort of thing. If you're in a parallel transfer workflow, at least the way that we do it, you're automatically comparing that cassette to two others from the same collection, usually recorded with the same machine, that sound almost identical. You can hear that loss in high frequency very easily when you're comparing against the other two. Because you're running multiple signal chains, it's sort of the same idea. You can easily compare multiple signal chains, and if something's going wrong, it's easy to hear that when you've got two others going at the same time. It can be easy. Well, it's an efficient way to handle short sides. So you have a cassette that's 45 minutes to a side, and after 20 minutes, it stops. The content goes away. In a one-to-one workflow, you're wondering, well, do I stop? I've got to figure out if there's something 5 minutes down the line, because in field recordings, that often happens. So what do? You listen to the whole thing while nothing else is transferring, or you try to take some shortcuts and try to scan the tape, see if there's anything there. In a parallel transfer environment, If one of your cassettes ends early, you just let it run. You're still transferring two others. It's still very efficient, and you're now 100% sure that there's no further content on that side. So these and some other things we find as real advantages. I'm going to stop there. We'll see what happens during questions. I have some diagrams I can put up if it seems appropriate during the questions, but I'll stop there. Thank you very much.